Good morning. Can you hear me? My name is Neil. I'm from the local area. Of course, you can see me in my shirt here. I'm native. And today I decided to wear this shirt. I wasn't going to, but I figured, you know, many of our nations have passed from cirrhosis, kidney damage, murdered, missing, all these things that's been a problem for us as a nation. So I decided to wear this in representation of those that are out there, not brought back home yet. So saying that, thank you. Allowing me to speak today to Rick. He's been coming to our talking circles. He got it. When COVID hit, we shut down everything, as well as, you know, society today was shut down back then. So we stopped everything, and then when it started opening back up slowly, I seen this guy in a car coming by after work. I was leaving a couple of times, and then later on they approached me and said, "Where's the talking circle at?" And it was Rick and his wife. And so I said, "Well, we don't have it right now because of COVID, but if you really interested, I can get some people together," I said, and he goes, "Okay." So it happened. We have a small circle. Every Thursday night, 6 p.m. we meet, and it varies, goes ups and down. Sometimes we have a few more people from the community, and sometimes we don't. We have other people from the 449 come out sometimes. TLC, the agencies in town, they come out every now and then. But it's been there. My group's called Join the Circle, Break the Cycle. And it's been going on since the 80s, I guess. And even before then, AA was introduced into Kokopa back in 1969 by a man, tribal member that was part of an AA group somewhere and brought it back to the reservation. He said, "We can start this group, let's do it." And they got all the paperwork submitted in, and then the meetings began. When I was 10 or 11 years old, they used to have the meetings on my reservation out there. And there was nothing going on at night in the evening on Friday nights. And me and my cousins would go there to eat the donuts. We knew they had donuts, so let's go, you know. And they let us in. And with our circle of AA or talking circle, we allow the children to come in, because we're all family, and what hurts the parents hurts the children. So we allow them to come in and sit and listen sometimes, or we ask them to say a few words sometimes if they're old enough. So that's, you know, that's the one thing we always do. And today I invited my family to come and to be part of my talk here. And I really don't talk to tell my story to anybody. And I didn't really want to do it. Rick asked me the first time. I said, "No, I don't want to do it." And then he asked me again. And I said, "No." So so here I am anyway. But, you know, I thought about it. And the talking circle is a lot different from the AE platform format. And so I thought about it, and I... To tell you the truth, I'm not really an AA from sobriety. I'm more spiritual, traditional way of sobriety. But I did try AA, and it was hard. I wasn't welcomed. So I stopped. I said, "It's not for me." But over the years, I started to learn it. And the 12 steps, I had to teach that to my people. And I still do today. So, and that's the reason why I, you know, didn't want to be up here. But at the same time, how are my people going to learn if I don't do this and be an example for them? So, and that's why I'm here. And those that are, you know, I had problems with calling myself an alcoholic, in which I am today, and also many other things. But, you know, it's for the newcomers, I was told, that we say these things. and I'm starting to understand a little bit more. Sometimes I ask Rafa about things if I have questions on, you know. So, but anyway, I thought about it, and I said, well, if it's a newcomer, I was once a newcomer and wasn't welcomed, but, you know, in this way, maybe they'll come in. Maybe that new person will come in and sit and listen. Maybe they'll get something out of my story. And so that's why I'm here today. And maybe it'll give you the faith, hope, and love, and strength, inspiration that, you know, that needs to be here. So, and I hope that I fulfill that. So, my name is Neil. I grew up on the reservation. When I was growing up, we didn't have no running water in the house, no electricity. And we had lanterns. We had a stove, wood-burning stove to heat us. And we lived in a mud house shack. And I never knew we were poor. I never knew that there was a world outside my reservation. And to the point of 6 years old, before 6 years old, I had fun growing up with my family. Traditionally, I was brought up. My parents never laid a hand on us or scolded us or shook us or nothing. They hugged us when we cried, took care of us that way. So growing up that way, you know, I see the kids today getting, you know, and even in the stores, you know, screaming their head off and stuff, and the parents are, you know, dragging them along and all these things, you know. But it was fun growing up. I mean, as a child, I had a great childhood. And grew a little bit older. They stuck me in first grade. All I knew was my language. I didn't understand English. And the teachers weren't very helpful. They just left us alone. And I had to learn from my peers in the classrooms. And I got held back. We got held back in first grade. And they moved us out because of our age to second grade. We started to learn English then. And at the same time, every recess, we fought. The boys didn't like us. So every break recess, we went out there, we were ready to fight. And they ganged up on us and until the bell rang for class to start again, and we'd go back in. Lunchtime, we started again. Every day was like that. Till I reached third grade, and I started to make friends. Not just relatives, cousins, but non-natives. And I started friendships with them, and we had fun. And then I get to my fifth grade. Everything was great. Liked going to school, seeing my friends. And then fifth grade, ran across a teacher, didn't like us. And this one Hispanic girl lost her pencil, and she blamed it on us. And we didn't know what she was talking about. And she said, I'm going to tell the teacher. And then we said, go ahead. So a teacher came straight to us and said, give her the pencil. And I said, we don't have it. And she said, I know you guys have it. Give us the pencil. And my friend said, just because we're Indians, you think we stole it? And she said, yes. And you give it back, she said. And so we just sat there. And then this other kid, a few rows down, said, here's the pencil, teacher. And from there on, the teacher never helped us in class. We just went to that class, and we sat there and drew. And drawing was our thing. So we just drew all through class, all through semester. And then I didn't like that. You know, I started to feel some way about it during that time. And I get to seventh grade. I just didn't want to go to school anymore. I wanted to drop out, and I did. I dropped out and then got into some trouble because of that, and then I got sent to a boarding school at 13, to a high school boarding school. And I lasted 3 months there. Talk about non-Indians and non-natives we were fighting with. Now I'm fighting with natives. And it was pretty bad. I almost lost my eye when I got jumped there. I got hit by a belt buckle and right in the side of my eye, barely missed my eye. And all the blood that came out scared the kids, so they ran. And I didn't want to be there anymore either. And, you know, for 3 months I was there running. I just sleep there and hop the fences. And we hopped, you know, you ever see those tennis courts with those fences that are really high? We used to scale those just to get out of the school. And we did things like that. And, you know, in between we drank and did other things that, you know, caused problem for us. And so finally I came back home, and one of the tribal members that worked at the school spoke for me and got me back in school. And by then, you know, I was drinking on the weekends with my friends whenever somebody had money to buy beer and things like that. So we'd go out and drink and party and then come back to school. Finished school, graduated with incomplete grades. They just wanted me out of there. So I left, went to high school, and same thing again. And it was, to me, I think about it today, I was hanging out with the wrong people, my cousins. And they kept on getting me into trouble, and I was left holding the bag. So anyway, got into trouble again. My parents saw me get on the school bus in the morning. But once I got up to the school, we jumped the fence again, and we'd be gone for the rest of the day, come back, catch the bus, and go back home. So my parents never knew anything for 3 months, and the truancy officer came to my house one day and said, "We need to talk with your mother." I said, "What?" And said, "Yes." So they spoke with her, and I hear my mom saying, "But he gets on the bus every morning." Oh, no. So they kicked me out. And then they got me set up to go to another boarding school, and that's where my sister and my best friend went, and some of my cousins were there too. So my dad came to me and said, "You know, if you get kicked out of this one, this last school here, don't bother coming back," he said. "Don't come back over here," he said. And you know, when he talked, people listened, and you don't talk back or nothing. So I said, okay. So I went to that school, and, you know, because of my sister and my cousins were there, it was okay. Got into a few fights, but that was okay. And then the first year, it was stayed in a boys' dorm, and it was okay. And then finally, they had an honor dorm there, too, that was co-ed. So I applied for it, and I got in. And I lived there for 3 years as an honor student. And I graduated from there. I didn't know what I was going to do when I got out of school. You know, when you're in a mix of things, that it seems like it's never going to end. So and that was the way I was thinking, was that I'm going to be in school forever, you know. But it was coming to an end, and it was doing it the right way. So I thought, you know, what am I going to do? And then as a kid, we always played Army games, and I loved the uniform and all that, the vehicles and stuff, and I said, hey, I'm going to sign up to go in the service. So once when I was a junior, the recruiters came to the school, and I signed up on a program for a year as a junior, and then when I became a senior, I kept in contact with my recruiter, and then once I graduated, I left. This is the thing I did, was I never told anybody, not even my parents, what I was doing. I graduated on a Thursday night, stayed at the school. Friday, I came home. Sunday, I told my mom, "Mom, I'm leaving to go into service." And she said, "What?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm leaving." She said, "When are you leaving?" I said, "Tomorrow." So next day, I packed up and left. And did the intake and all that. Basic training was great. I loved it. And as soon as they gave us a break, and all we did was drink, got crazy. And then I thought that was normal, being in the service. So I kept on going, and then finally finished basic training, came back and partied with my friends around here for about a week or so, and then I went to my first duty station. So I get to my duty station, and the newbie, they called me. And So the first day of work after doing end processing, we have formation, and our platoon sergeant said, called a couple of names out and said, take the newbie with you. And so I went with them. And so we had a 5-ton dump truck, and we were supposed to get that road tested. I don't know what that meant, but we went to McDonald's, and then the liquor store opened. We went to the liquor store, and we're down the beach all day. So I came back staggering, and this is my first day. And at 5 o'clock, we had formation, and everybody was looking at me and laughing because I was barely standing up. And so the next day came, same thing. And I said, whoa, this is the Army, all right. I said, I like this. So Friday came, Friday night came, and I didn't know what to do. I was alone out there, far from home. And so I walked out in the hallway about like 6 or 7, and there was 2 kegs in the hallway. All the doors were open. People were just filling their cups and mugs or whatever. And it stayed like that till Sunday. So I enjoyed it. You know, I went out there. This is fun. Drank till Sunday. Then Monday we started all over again. And then it was like that for 2 years. Every weekend. And, you know, my feelings came and went. I know I shouldn't have been doing that. And there was a few people in there that were, you know, didn't do anything. They were straight. They were going to college and stuff like that. But I wasn't like that. And after 2 years, I got shipped to Germany. And I was scared of flying. I'm sorry, I drank as much as I could before I get on flight. And I didn't like the takeoff and the landing. So I flew from West Coast to East Coast. Went to Delaware. And get there, and they had this old Army C-1 plane. If any of you guys have been in service, C-1 plane's a cargo plane. It's got no windows in there. Big, giant one. So we were supposed to fly out of there, and so we started drinking at 10 o'clock. And they said, oh, at 1 o'clock, it's going to be ready. Flight, be, you know, we'll load up. 1 o'clock came. Said, oh, it's been pushed to 3 o'clock. So 3 o'clock came. We're going to be leaving at 4 o'clock. And by then, we're drinking all day long. So by the time we got on that flight at 5 o'clock, I was pretty much out of it. And we got in the plane, and those planes are so uncomfortable. And it's not really for, you know, commercial type. It's more military type. So the seats were aluminum, just straight up, no back and forth on the back, just straight up canvas seats, buckle in. No windows, couldn't tell what time it was. I knew we flew all night, though. And at times, I thought we were going to land, fall in the sea, because it went down a couple of times, went back up, and then finally we landed in Frankfurt. And went to my duty station, and there I was again, a newbie. And somebody showed the newbie around. So we ended up back in Frankfurt again that night, and toured the bad place. And then found out that my roommate had these beer coasters on the wall. And I said, what are those? And he said, oh, they're beer coasters. He had over 200 different types of beer he drank. And he posted it on the wall. And I said, wow, that's cool. You know, I want to do that. So every weekend we went out to the pubs, and we collected beer coasters. Yeah, we collected beer coasters. And sometimes they wouldn't let us in because we're Americans. And so we're okay with that because it was a lot of other pubs. So and that's all we did for about a whole year. During our time, got into a few troubles. And then that was my end of tour. And duh me, thinking, hey, I got nothing to, no skills when I get out. I'm going to re-enlist again. So in Germany, I re-enlisted. And I picked a different MOS occupation. So I came back to the States, ended up in West Virginia for 3 months for retraining. And had to try out the beard there. And got into some big trouble this time. I had a lot of blackouts and one blackout, I woke up and there was a lieutenant standing in front of me saying, come on, let him go. I'll take care of him. And I had my friends holding me back, and I don't know why, you know, I just woke up from a blackout there. And next morning, I got called into the first sergeant's office, and he chewed me up and down, threw things left and right, and for about, I don't know, almost an hour, I think, I just stood there. And then finally, he said, what do you got to say for yourself? He said, and I said, enlist me into ADAP, drug and alcohol program. And he got nice with me and sat down, we talked. And after that, you know, I had counseling, which didn't mean nothing to me. It didn't. I just sat there and listened to the counselor and couldn't open up. And it wasn't time. So I stayed there until I finished school there and I got sent down to Texas. And there I was a newbie again. And everywhere you go in life, and not just the services, you have your groups. You have your nationalities of different races. So you try to find where you could fit in. But in the service, they try to, you know, hey, come with us, you know. We got beer, we got wine, whatever you want, you know. And then you go along with that for a short time. Then you find your group eventually. But me, I was a loner. I really didn't like groups. So I went out on my own, drank a lot on my own. And so because of that, I got into a lot of trouble by myself. And ended up in the hospital a few times, stitches. During a blackout, I woke up in the hospital again, and they were telling me that somebody busted a bottle over my head because I was trying to fight somebody. So I was getting stitches there, and I felt a little pain. I wasn't totally numb, but I got stitched up. And so I went back, and here comes the counseling again. They say that once you get enrolled in a duty station, it follows you throughout your service, time of service. So they found me, and they said, hey, you need counseling. So went back to counseling, and on the weekends, that was my time, and I went out and did, you know, did a lot of drinking and damage out there, not to people, but property and to myself, too. And so I go in on Tuesdays for counseling, and how was your weekend? Oh, it was good, you know. And then there was another guy sitting in a counseling session with us, too, and he saw me at the bar during the weekend, and I guess he told her about what I did, and they were asking me stuff, and they're looking at me saying, confess, you know, but I didn't say nothing. I said, yeah, it was okay, you know, and so anyway, then they got me on Anabuse. I think some of you old-timers know what Anabuse is. I'm still around, I think, so that scared me, and I took it for a couple of weeks, and I, you know, because of that, I didn't want to go into convulsions or whatever it does, you know. I didn't want to see that or experience that, so I stopped drinking and for a couple of weeks, and then finally I just said, I can't do it. So I got it off. I took it off, you know, I got off of that myself, and cleansed my body for a week or so, and then I started drinking again. And then Texas, my last duty station, that's where I couldn't take the military anymore. You know, my drinking was taken over, and I was going full-time with that. So it was really hard trying to do what they told me to do and listen to orders and things like that. And I gave up, and I just kept on drinking. And eventually I got out. They discharged me, honorable discharge. And I was glad that I came out. But at the same time, you know, I should have stuck it out. I told myself that was the right thing to do. But I was really sick with the drinking, and I thought it might stop, you know. But once I got out, it didn't. And I was near a town that they had concerts a lot, and it was known for music. So on the weekends, sometimes we know of a band that we like. We go down there and party. and come back. And so I decided, hey, once I get out of here, I'm going to move down there. So once I got out, packed up my stuff, came home, told my friends out here, I'm going to stay here for 30 days and I'm going to leave. They said, no, you're not. You're going to stay here and be like us, they said. And they, when I left here, they weren't doing anything. When I came back, they weren't doing anything. And they said, you're going to be just like us, they said. I said, no, I'm not. So 30 days later, I packed up my stuff and left. And I went to the city and stayed in a hotel and looking for a place. And then finally I found a small apartment. And I moved over there. And then once I got settled in, and I had money too. When I was in service, I saved money. And so I moved in. And then the first night, started drinking. And every night, I started drinking. Every day, I drank. And my money was running out. And my neighbor, he was a security guard. And one day, he saw me outside. And he said, hey, you want to make some money for, you know, a couple hours? I said, okay. So he took me to a construction site and said, sit here, don't let anybody take anything that don't work here. And I said, okay. So I sat out there for a couple of hours, and then he came back, picked me up, and paid me. I said, oh, this is cool. So then I started more frequently. And so I had money coming in to drink. So that's what I did, drank. And eventually that got into a job as a security guard. And I worked long hours, but I was sober. You know, I worked long hours. On my days off, I calculated, hey, at midnight I can go by there, buy beer, and go home, start drinking. The next 2 days I'll be free to drink. So I did that. I, you know, hit the Circle K or whatever that was open and buy beer and go back home. One thing is that, you know, when I talked about leaving the U.S. and going to Germany, I weighed about like 170 pounds. When I came back, I weighed almost 300 pounds, 275 pounds I came back. And when I got at their service, I weighed around that much too, 275 pounds. So my only transportation was a 12-speed bicycle. And I rode that thing everywhere. And, you know, carrying 12 packs, cases, fell down, crashed and burned a couple of times, and drunk, and covering 5-8 miles on that thing, up and down the streets, and, oh, man. But anyway, I stayed there, and then this new guy moved in next door, a short guy with a limp, and he came over, we started talking. And he said, come on over, he said, all right. So I went over there, and I never bought food. You know, I'd buy, you know, out of a whole week, I'd just eat a bag of chips or a sandwich if I'm lucky. And all I did was drink. So I said, hey, I'm hungry, man. I saw his, you know, cabinet with food in there, and he said, all right, I'll cook for you, he said. And so he cooked me some spaghetti. And then we sat there and talked and talked and talked, and then finally he said, hey, let's go. I've been in a motorcycle accident, still going through the court, trying to get some money out of it, but they really messed up my leg. That's why it's short. They said, it hurts real bad, he said, and I ran out of my pain medication. So you want to come with me to the store, get something? I said, all right. So we went to the store, and then this is where I got introduced to Mad Dog, MD-2020, and he brought a couple of bottles. So I said, oh, I never tried this before, and wow, that was an event. Hey? So from there, I started drinking that, and I went from, started off on one pint to 2 pints to 3 pints. And by that time, I had a friend came by. I met this guy here and there. I saw him around. We talked every now and then. He said, hey, I need a roommate. You want to come move in with me? I said, okay. I was about to get my electric shut off and everything, you know, so I said, okay. So I didn't have hardly anything, so I moved in with him, slept on the floor. I didn't really, wasn't into comfort or anything, so I didn't have nothing, just my sleeping bag and blanket, and that was about it. So I moved in with him, and I try to help pay bills because in between I just, you know, I said, oh, he's going to pay for it anyway. So drank my money up and started getting mad. And then I started stealing from him to buy that pint and coins, you know, because he saved a lot of quarters. So I ran across him and I started taking some of it. He'll never know. So over the years, you know, I did that and started getting into more trouble. And then one night I was on the phone. At the time, there was a girl that I liked, and she lived about 40 miles out of town. And I ran into her in town one day, and we started talking. And then she gave me her number, so I called her up on the landline. And I was sitting in the kitchen and then drinking, and she didn't know it. And I finally passed out on sitting on the counter, and I fell and hit my head on the corner of the appliance. And my roommate found me in a puddle of blood when he came home. And he didn't know what to do, so he called a friend of ours, and he came. He was looking at it, cleaned me up, and I came too. And I said, what happened? He goes, and my roommate said, I just found you on the floor. And he said, oh, okay. So he was pissed because, of course, I was drinking. So anyway, eventually, he came and talked to me about that. And I, you know, he just said, you know, you got to stop drinking, he said. I hate to say this, he said, you either stop drinking or leave. I said, oh, okay, let me go get my stuff. So, and he let me stay a few more days, and I had a little money during that time. I worked a few hours, and then I had a little money, so I went downtown. Downtown's about like 5 miles from where we lived at, and I walked down there, and I heard this band was going to be playing, opening up a new CD, so I said, okay, great, I like that band, so I'll go down there. So I went down there. I started drinking in there, and then I didn't have enough to get drunk, but I felt good listening to the band. And then after we closed, I wandered around downtown for a little bit. And then downtown, there's a river that runs through town. It's a big, wide river. On the other side is a big park. So, and it started to snow. It was cold. And I never had enough jackets or, you know, hardly had anything. So I was freezing, and I decided to go down there. And there's a footbridge that goes across that river. And so I went out there. It was about like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, snowing. And so I go out there and to the middle of the bridge. Boy, you guys are patient. So I looked down in the river, saw little chunks of snow going by. I thought to myself, if I jump, what's going to take me? Is it going to be a shock of the water? Will I fight it for air and end up on the beach or shore somewhere? Or will I go down? Will the water take me under? And I thought, well, if I jump, maybe the water will take me under. And I wouldn't have to fight so much. So as I was standing there, out of the corner of my eye, I see somebody walking, coming towards me to cross that bridge. And I said, oh, great. Now I'm going to get beat up and mugged and throw it over. So I wouldn't have to worry about jumping. So anyway, I just stood there. We'll see what he does. So stood there looking at the river, looking. He's coming. It's taking forever to get there, you know. Ah, come on. So finally, he got close, and I can hear him behind me, and he put his hand on my back and said, hang in there, brother. Then I heard him walk off. I stood there thinking, what? And I stood there for about a few minutes, and then I turned and looked. There was nobody out there. So I walked back to the house, and I thought about it. Maybe I'm still drunk. And then And I packed up my stuff. And before that, I met some friends in the bar playing pool. And we hung out a lot on the weekends. So I asked one of those guys, I said, hey, I need a place to stay. And he said, oh, come on over. So I went and they let me sleep in their car. So so I slept in the car. And then this other friend said, hey, you can come stay with me, but you can only stay for 2 weeks. I said, okay. So I grabbed my blanket and moved in with him. And this was the east section of town. A lot of violence. And so I moved over there, and we scrounged for pennies just to get a quart of beer or something every night. And did that for about a week. And then one day we were drinking. We normally don't drink in that area. We go out somewhere and drink and come back. And then so we started drinking that night there in the neighborhood. And it was his cousin that was across the street. So we were partying over there, and they said, oh, we're going to go do a, you know, get some more beer. We'll be back. And do you want to come? I said, no. By then, I was pretty out of it. And I said, no, I'm going to stay here. And they said, okay. So I stayed there and waited and waited. You know, when you want everything to happen real fast, you know, when you're in that stage. So I was thinking, God, where are they at? You know, they just left, you know. And they should be back by now, you know. Nothing happened, so I decided to go back to the apartment. And, you know, this is where I started to black out a little bit. And I remember walking, and then somebody grabbing me by the arm, and then we ended up fighting. And I was so numb, bits and pieces of it. I stood there, and the guy punched me. And I just stood there looking at him. He didn't knock me down or nothing. I'm thinking, wow, this guy can't knock me down. And I took some more punches and more. And I kicked him down a couple of times. He got back up, started punching me again. I just stood there. And then finally he stopped. He came up to me and he stopped. And I came, you know, my mind got clear for a second there. And he looked behind me. His eyes went behind me. And I just turned and halfway my head, and somebody had a bat or something popped me in the jaw. And next thing I knew, I was on all fours, blood gushing out. And next thing I hear is the police coming. And then police came questioning me. I couldn't even talk. I didn't know. And the ambulance, I remember getting in, they were putting me in the ambulance. And the next thing I knew is I woke up in the ER. And the nurse was saying, we're going to put this big hose down your throat and pump up your stomach. So I said, oh, no. I said, go ahead. So they started to, and I started to fight them. And eventually I got the hose down my throat and pumped up my stomach. And after that, I went through room after room for tests and stuff all that night. And finally they left me alone the next morning. And there's a little bone that holds up your eye. And I think it's called a hyoid bone. And they broke that. And then my jaw was completely broken in half. And plus that guy beating on my face swelled up my head really bad. So anyway, I was there, and the nurse kept on coming in here in my bedside saying, do you have a heart condition? And I kept on hearing that, you know, do you have a heart problem? I said, no. So and they said, well, there's something strange going on. We're going to put a heart monitor on you. So they had that on me for 3 days. And come to find out, I was, you know, malnutritioned. And my friends finally found out where I was at. And they came, and the expression on their faces when they saw my head. And they left. And during this time, none of my family knew where I was at. They didn't know if I was dead or alive. I'd call my mother every 6 months and let her know that I'm okay. And so that was my life. And so they didn't even know this happened. And I stayed there for about a week at that hospital. And social service came. And they kept on asking me questions. Do you want us to contact your parents, anybody? I said, no. And maybe my roommate, I said. So I gave him the number. My roommate came, and we talked. And finally they said, we're trying to get your services, they said. And at the same time, they weren't doing nothing with my face. And finally, she said, are you veteran? I said, yes. And they said, there's a VA center nearby. Do you want to go there? And I said, yeah. So they discharged me. They called a cab. And I couldn't even, this eye was so dropped down, I just saw double. I couldn't even walk straight. So, and I had to walk to the cab. A lot of help they were. So I was hanging on to the walls trying to get to the cab. I finally get down there, and then I couldn't really see the cab either. And then this guy comes up and said, you call a cab? And I said, yeah. The VA center? I said, yeah. So they took me over there, and it's about like 60 miles away. So I get down there, and they took me in. They brought a wheelchair out. So I got in a wheelchair, and they wheeled me in, went to the doctor. They looked me inside out, tipped me over everything, and they said, okay, we're going to do some surgery on you. I said, okay. So they got me a room, and almost a month later, they said, we scheduled that date, and we're going to do surgery on you. By then, my jaw had reconnected, so they had to break my jaw in order to straighten it out. And I was in bed all the time, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I never thought about coming back home or nothing. I just said, well, I don't know what I'm going to do once I get out of here. So anyway, they took me into surgery around 1 o'clock, and I got out at about 7 o'clock at night. They wired my jaw, and then they fixed my eye, and then they wired my jaw shut and worked for it to heal. So I get back to the room, and then it was like that for another 3 months and 3 weeks in that hospital, recovering. And only two people came and saw me because they knew where I was, and those were my friends. And after that, I had no visitation from anybody. But I was okay because that was Neil. And I didn't call home or tell anybody. So finally I got healed enough to be released. And the social worker came and said, do you have a place to go to? Do you have a home? I said, yeah, it's not here. And do you want to go home? I said, no. And they said, well, we got two options. He said, we can put you through a drug and alcohol treatment program that's here with the VA. He said, or you can apply for housing here, and there's a lot of people that are homeless that live here too, he said. I said, put me in for both. So a week later, he comes back and said, okay, you got accepted for both, he said. I said, all right. So I went to the treatment center. It was pretty nice, and met a lot of great guys there, and these guys were like retired military men that were officers, lieutenant, captains, chief warrants, smart people, educated, and but the alcohol got to them too, and that's what we had in common. So staying there, you know, we had group sessions, and there was a doctor that looked just like Wilford Brimley, just like him. So he'd do our education sessions. So every morning we'd get up, go to breakfast, come back, and then he'd say, write something on the board. I'll come back and, you know, we'll go through a session. So write something on there, and then he'll come back and he'll relate it to alcohol or drugs or how the body works and that, or mind, stuff like that. And everybody was given a chance to talk except me because my jaws were shut. And for 2 weeks, no, I think it was about 30 days like that. And then finally the doctor said, hey, we're going to take those rubber bands off your jaw. I said, all right. During that time, I suffered. You know, I didn't have no money. Nobody gave me money. I never asked for anything. So Tuesday nights, they would come and play bingo for 50 cents. And the commissary was, back at that time, was pretty cheap in there. So you can buy these tickets. You win a ticket, 50 cents, you can exchange it for an item at the store. So I went every Tuesday and played and won some games. I saved all that 50 cents and finally bought some things for myself because they wouldn't provide it. I met this guy that kept the barrack side, and I said, "Hey, I need some shoes." And he looked at it. "Well, you still got some soles left. There's nothing wrong with them." And every time I asked him that, he'd give me the same answer. So I saved up enough tickets to buy me some tennis shoes. And during those times, my jaw was still wide shut. So, boy, that popcorn sure smelled good. And somebody would say, "Here, you can have my popcorn." And I'm sitting there, "Oh, okay," you know. And I got so desperate, I crunched little pieces and put it between my teeth just to taste it, you know. And it was worse at the mess hall. I was so starving and only liquid stuff, you know. And they gave me that nutrient drink, that Sescatel. And I didn't know what it was, but I didn't like drinking. So I mixed it into my coffee, so it was like a malt. And it was great, you know. So I loved those things. So anyway, once I got done with treatment, during treatment, this is what changed my life, my way of thinking, was that the doctor, Wilford, he told us, he said, "If you have any injure yourself or hurt yourself in any way," he said, "I'm a doctor," he said, "I'll see you," he said, "but you have to be working hard at your recovery," he said, "before I see you. If you're not, then I'm not going to see you," he said. So one day I was jogging, and I stepped into a gopher hole, twisted my ankle really bad. And so the next day he came, and I said, "Hey, can you see, look at my ankle?" And he said, "Okay." So went in. He said, "Oh, it's sprained pretty bad." He said, gave me an ACE wrap and wrapped it up. And he goes, "Oh, you're native, right?" And he said, and I said, "Yeah." He said, "You ever heard of this guy, Don Bartlett?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, I just came from New Mexico, and I went to his talk. There was a conference down there," he said. "And I have a recording of him," he said. "And if you promise to give me back this recording, I'll let you listen to it," he said. I said, "Okay." So that night, I would listen to it. And this guy, Dr. Dan Bartlett, is a native. And he was born FAS, fetal alcohol syndrome, but they didn't know it at the time. His parents were alcoholics. They built a cabin outside of town, no electricity, no running water. And this was in the 30s. So when he was born, he had half a nose, and he had a cleft mouth severely, and he had a hole up in his mouth. So he didn't know how to eat. He didn't know how to talk or anything. And the parents just left him alone. And they were never home. So he started to learn to walk and stuff. And he didn't know about society or anything at the age of five and six. So he wandered down the valley, and he found the city dump. And he was hungry all the time, and so the people would throw away food, so he'd stuff that hole with his food, and he said it made my stomach feel better. And he didn't have no friends, so he saw the rats there, and he played with the rats. He said, "Those were my friends." He said, "Ran and jumped and played all day. I was sad when night came because they went and disappeared on me," he said. So he got a little bit older, and then somebody said, "There's a child up there that needs to go to school." So the school came and said, "Hey, you need to send your son to school." So they said, "Okay." So the mother took him down to school, dropped him off. And the kids came, humiliated him, tortured him, bullied him. The teacher took him in and threw him in the closet, locked him in there, and this went on for a long time. And one day he was going home, the kids came, tried to, you know, say, "Oh, you're my friend," and all the stuff. So they were walking down the road, and they took him to the forest, and they tied his hands up, and they started beating his face and calling him freak, weirdo. And they left him all bloody, tied to a tree. And somebody was walking by, some man, saw him and untied him and said, run home. I'll watch. I'll watch you go home so nobody would bother you, he said. So he ran home. And he says, you know, I don't know where this man came from because he was from a different area, but he just showed up that day, he said. So anyway, I listened to that tape. It's just amazing what us humans can do to a child. Even that goes on today, but this child was like that. And the town didn't like him. Nobody wanted him. His mother did. Gave him some love every now and then. And that night when he went home from the beating, his father saw him and his shirt was all bloody and started kicking him, beating him up some more. So eventually this went on, and then school was really bad to him, and then he kept on going back, and then this rich lady in the community, in this town, she owned stores and stuff like that, really rich, he said, and started to talk to him, comfort him, and he was scared of her, and then eventually befriended her, and she's the one that took care of him. Took him to surgeries he needed. He went through 17 surgeries for his face. And today he's a doctor, and he's got a big family. So this was back in 1987. So I come back home by then and work for the tribe. And then one day somebody, one of our programs was putting on a conference, and I saw his name on there. I said, no way. So I went, and it was him. He came, talked about his life, and he's trying to write a book, and he's trying to have a movie made, but he's got to get permission from the people, and the people weren't giving him permission to do this. They wanted him dead. So anyway, I met him. And I told him, I said, you changed my life. And we talked some more after that. He survived. If he could do it, I could do it, I said. He went through a lot more than I did. And I lived there at the VA for 6 months after I got out of treatment, had my jaw was healed, and, you know, just living there through a lot of BS of the staff there and trying to create problems for me and things like that. But anyway, one day I was the youngest VA there, and all these people were like 60, 70, 80 years old. They had nobody left in this world. I'd catch this one man. Everybody was afraid of him, a big, tall guy, but he talked to me. And I saw him one day looking out the window, and I said, what are you looking at? And he says, that's where I'm going to be pretty soon, he said. And then right across from the VA is a cemetery. That's where they go. I said, oh, okay. So walked on by, but every now and then he'd sit and talk with me. And then this other old man, he was about 75 years old, and he said he lived off the streets in some town, and the kids would come, and when I got my monthly check, he said, and then I'd be life of the party, he said. They'd let me sleep in their house, and then once my money goes, they'd throw me back in the backyard, he said. So I said, oh, okay. And it dawned on me one day, I said, I don't need to be here. I'm too young. I was only 28 years old at the time. And thinking that my life was coming to an end, and then all these people there made me realize that I have a lot more to live for. And at that moment, I realized that I had family here. So I got out of there, and I went back to town I was in and saw my friends that were drinking, and they took me out, and I told them, I'm not drinking anymore. And they said, oh, okay. Well, you don't mind if we drink in front of you? And I said, go ahead. So finally they just said, you know, we're proud of you. I wish I could do that. You're strong. And I said, well, I guess, I said, but I'm planning on going home, I said. So I didn't have any money. So they found work for me, this company that did yard work. So I went and worked for them for about 2 weeks. And then finally made enough money for transportation to get home. So I packed up my stuff and left and came back home. So I get home and word gets around quick. So that night, my friends were coming around, knocking my door. Hey, let's go to Yuma. Let's go to Somerton. Of course, that meant let's go get some beer, let's go drink. I said, no, I don't want to go anywhere. I said, okay, you sure? Every night for 2 weeks, somebody came over to the house, asked me to go take a ride with them or go out or something. And after a while, stopped. And it felt good. And during that time, I had to take care of my mother. So I think she was proud of what I'd done. So stayed like that for a while. And then, I don't know. Today I think about is that I look at life today is that there's so much in this world. We can't be bored. I tell the young kids that too. There's so much to do and be part of in this world. It's all good. Doesn't have to be alcohol and drugs or anything like that. Keep a clear mind. Focus on things you want to do in life. Your dreams. My wife and I still have dreams we haven't fulfilled. Our bucket list. So I think about that, you know, and I tell the kids, do it now if you're able to. Because, you know, my thing is someday I may not be able to walk. I might be stuck in a wheelchair and let it be a long way from now. And I say, at that time, I'll think about my memories. I'll laugh, cry, but I enjoyed life. And today it's, in the spiritual way I began with, you know, my sobriety is through spirituality. My parents were very strong in the spiritual way. I was brought up that way. And teenage, like a lot of teenagers, they go astray. Mine was an experience of life led by my cousins. So, and you know, but I had a choice. I had a choice to say no, and I didn't. So I went along with them. So when I came back, I started learning my language again. At 6 years old, I was fluent Kokopah. When I came back, I couldn't speak Kokopah. It was hard. I understood it. It wouldn't come out right. So my first job was translating for the elders. And it was great because I learned a lot of new words. I started to talk again. And I started to understand who I am. And it took me many years, but I came back in that circle to where I was born again. And it's really exciting today and powerful that what I've learned over the years with my own family and my tribe and what we do out there, our beliefs, our tradition and culture. And I enjoy that today. And thank you to my wife that, you know, she's understanding, very understanding that to have somebody like that in my life to say, okay, go ahead. And so we have a busy schedule. Sometimes I feel like I work 7 days a week. Sometimes I do, but that's my life. I just keep on going. And people call and say, I know you're busy. I know you're doing something, and they're usually right. I'm out there doing something, out there busy, and I created that. Many years ago during my addiction, I prayed for something like this. But be careful what you pray for, though, because it has attachments. So I prayed for this, and then all of a sudden these other things came up, and said, oh, okay. So responsibilities. During my times, I sobered up. I stayed sober for 3 years, and then just because somebody said something, and it got bigger and bigger gossip, you know, and finally I couldn't take it, and I said, well, I'm going to drink. So I did, and my aunt said, heard you're drinking. I said, yeah, everybody says I'm drinking, I might as well drink. Did they force it down you? Did they hold it and open your mouth? And I said, no. I said, okay, and I walked away. And that was after 3 years I've been here. And after that, about 7 years. And I had a child. For 20 days, he passed away. That just kind of reinforced my sobriety. Life's too short to be arguing, putting up walls against each other, family. You know, there's not many things that that hurt me emotionally, physically, mentally, but spiritually, but that child did. I could have went out and drank or whatever, but my mind was okay. Letting him go was the hardest thing. But I'm okay with it today. I don't talk about that, but I'm okay with it today. And my sobriety is good. It's good. I don't need that anymore. And I live in a way that sometimes it's traditional. Like today. The reason why I didn't come to any of the functions last night and this morning and probably tomorrow is that I'm going through a ceremony right now for you guys. And I stand here and talk before you guys because of that. And it's an old tradition that I was told that I must do before I speak in the community or among people. So, and, you know, I told my wife, I said, I'm going to start Wednesday. Said, okay, what do we need? So, anyway, today will be my last day. We're having another ceremony in the morning. So, that's my life. That's very powerful, I believe, to myself. And it's between me and my Creator that I'm okay with. And I have people that believe in me today, that people come and listen to me at the talking circles, at the ceremonies, and in the communities. And through my prayers years ago that I wanted to be somebody important in my community, I am that today. Do things for the families out there when their time of need. We're having a meeting. We had a loss Thursday. I was there for the family. And today we're having another meeting for another loss. And that funeral will be coming up next week sometime, and I'll be there for them again. So these roles that we have in their positions in the community, that it's not really given to anybody. You have to earn it. You have to earn respect of the families. And people know, you know. Sometimes I don't have to tell them who I am. From, you know, my reputation, I guess. They heard about me. And they'll come and seek me sometimes. I had people come from Washington State driving through here and said, hey, I heard about you. I want to come and do a ceremony. I said, okay, come on out. So they come out, and then, like, this one couple came through here years ago. And they wanted a ceremony. I said, okay. So they came out, and it was just us. And we got done and they left. And then years later, I found a note on my ceremonial grounds saying, hey, we came through, dropped this off for you. So they didn't bother to call me or nothing, but they probably knew I was busy. So it's good to feel that. It's good to feel needed, to feel wanted, and because we're family. And meeting Rick opened up many doors for me, allowing more people to come in. And my father had a church, and it was always open to the community of Yuma and those that traveled through and so forth. So he always left it open. And then we have, you know, some people out there, we don't want them in here, you know. But that's pretty much gone now, because we have connections in town with the Crossroads Mission, the other agencies in town. We work with them. They come out for our functions and things like that. So it's been a good community growing. Many years ago, it was like that. You know, we separated colors. And we're not like that anymore. And we shouldn't, as beings, we shouldn't be that way. And, you know, I think that the Creator gave us all colors to see what we can do with, you know, each one of us. And then if we get the right code and come together in one, as one, no color at all, I think that's what He wants, instead of fighting amongst each other all the time. So, and I think that every now and then, and the addiction, I lost my brother to cirrhosis. He drank and drank, and we kept on telling him, hey, you're gonna hurt yourself. And he said, hey, don't worry about it, it's me, it's just me. Yeah, but we suffered for it all the way to this end. And it was pretty sad. And then my other brother lost a kidney. But he was lucky enough, he quit drinking, and then he eventually stopped. So, but am I close? Somebody ring the time? How much time I got? Somebody recording? Okay, taking time? No? I'll be here till noon then. Okay. My other half of my life here, eh? Let me get my other notebook, hey? Yeah. But it's been good, and you know, it's tiresome sometimes, and I admire the people that put this on, because it's a lot of work. You know, me and Diane texting, messaging back and forth, and anyway, it's been good. I'm proud of who I am today, and I'm proud of you guys for being here, carrying the message and being forward with this for the newcomers behind you, for the many that will be coming behind you, and let us all stay well and be healthy in this way. Clear mind, thinking, clear focus in our path. Thank you.